really pleasure to be here. So what I will do is I'll give a very brief introduction on the dark matter problem. It's basically one of the key results recently to show that dark matter really exists. And then some direct detection, talking about how you actually do this. Now I'll basically concentrate on the detector. It's in full operation, and we already have a result submitted. So we'll talk about the performance of the detector, the result. And finally, I will talk about the work we are basically working together now for the next phase, a much bigger detector. Actually, the dark matter problem starts much earlier, like 70 years ago, when the Swiss astronomer Fincke, when he was measuring the galaxy dynamics in the cluster. So he realized the galaxies are moving too fast. Then the matter inside can hold it. So the only explanation at that time, he just said it must be a dark matter in the galaxy cluster. But this was a long time ago. So now if you look at a smaller scale, for example, you look at a galaxy, you measure the rotational curve as just the rotational velocity of along the R. What you really expect is when the R goes bigger, the velocity is supposed to drop with this relation. When R goes bigger, this is supposed to drop like this, if you take into account all the masses included in the R radius. But what happens if you measure all the spiral galaxies? They all behave like this. The rotational velocity actually is a constant, way beyond the visible disk. Okay? So what I mean is the matter you see here is not enough to maintain a flat rotational curve. There must be a lot of matter we don't see inside. Okay. If you go in a galaxy's cluster scale, for example, here is a measurement by gravitational lensing. What happened by Einstein predict that the masses, gravities modify the space. So what happens if you have a big mass in the foreground, distant stars will travel, for example, the stars here, but then the light will be banded. So for observers of us, we will see more than one image. So what happened here is all these blue ones are actually from one galaxy imaged by the foreground galaxy cluster. So what you can do is you can do a model to put masses in the foreground galaxy cluster. Then see how much mass you need in order to produce such matter. Then you end up with a lot of matter needed. This is the mass of each individual galaxy. And you see in the background, you see that you need a huge amount of masses, which in order to produce such image. Now, this is the one I really want to show. This comes later last year. All these theories here, people, non-believers, always think, well, you can always modify the theory of gravity. Now, at larger scales, the strength is different. You can modify it. And then they could explain the galaxy rotational curve. But here, this is two big clusters colliding. Okay, after the collision, the pink ones are the baryons. Okay, so basically, after the collision, the dark matter just move forward and left the baryons behind, because the dark matter doesn't have this kind of force like baryons, like kind of drag force. So this is measured by the Chandra satellite, but then other observational methods going in to measure using gravitational lensing to see where's the dark matter. So you will see that the dark matter and the baryonic matter is completely separate. So this cannot be explained by modified gravity. Okay? So this is the strongest evidence that dark matter do exist. Okay? You can't explain with changing the theory. Okay. So more precise measurement, you know this WMAP, this microwave anisotropy probe, basically measuring the microwave background radiation. This radiation carries the information when the radiation and matter decouple in the early universe. So you basically measure all these clumps of the temperature fluctuation. That embedded with a lot of information about the history of the universe. So for example, the flatness of the universe, depend on distribution of the smallest point, that gives you the angular distribution. Looking at the angle depending on the universe is flat or open, that gives you different angles. So that angle tells you the universe is very closely flat. So the detailed analysis of this, different peaks also tells you the different components of the matter content because they interact in different length scale. So the measurement basically gives you, this is WMAP data only, assuming a flat universe. That gives you a very tight measurement error bar. So this is the matter content of the universe. This is the baryon content of the universe. So you see here, it's clearly this huge amount of matter cannot be baryon. So this is the current number we have. So mostly the universe is dark matter, dark energy. And then the matter is this part, and then the baryons, what we see like the stars and the Earth and you and me, only this very small part. So this is the part of the thing that we really need to look for, because this is the overwhelming evidence show this exists. So there's many candidates. I'll just show you one of the candidates. I think most of you are working on CMS. This is what you're looking for, supersymmetry. It just turned out this is not invented for cosmology, not invented for dark matter. But if this is true, this gives you the most elegant candidate for dark matter particles. Because if you think about this, it's producing the early universe in the Big Bang. And then when the universe expands, and then the annihilation rate it becomes so low they don't meet each other, and then this frees out. And then you go through the calculation, you find that today, and this gives you the right cross-section, the right mass, and the right abundance to account for this dark matter. So here, looking at the rotational curve, you already see, just give you an idea. This is the visible disk of the galaxy. The dark matter really extend beyond the whole size. So basically, as you go further and further, you include more and more dark matter. So that gives you basically a proportional here between the mass and the radius. And that gives you the flat rotational curve. So here we just simply assume this is in a particle form, let's say WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles, just floating around the whole halo. We assume a standard distribution. And this is the mass distribution of the dark matter in the halo. Okay.
Is that just an artist's depiction, or is the relative size?
This one?
Yeah.
This is just artistic. It's not really, but it could be bigger. If you think about a cluster, and then you couple with many other galaxies, and between the galaxies, there's a huge amount. Like I showed the red one before, so it's everywhere. But the relative ratio it can be in.
Rotation curve, you know that it extends out to at least three times the galaxy matter size, right?
Yeah. But on the plot I have, but actually well beyond even more than 10 times.
Dark matter halos for galaxies go up to about 300 kiloparsecs.
How big is that compared to the galaxy?
The galaxy might be 20 kiloparsecs.
So I've never understood this. If you just had uniform dark matter everywhere in space, you wouldn't see any change to the rotation curve. Right?
Yeah, you need a halo.
You need it to fall off
in excess density. And also, you wouldn't see any lens either.
Yeah.
It's
sorry.
Not everywhere. It's like that little spiky diagram you showed. It's
really
yeah. So, but it's many, many times bigger than the galaxy.
Right.
So how is it that the stars inside a galaxy are affected?
This is in the very early part when the universe just started, and then this one has to have an initial seed. Basically, this is needed for the galaxy formation.
Can you go back to that rotation curve for a moment?
So I was saying
that the curve starts to fall off at maybe 8 kiloparsecs normally. If you just had the disk, and you go out to 30. Okay, so it's a factor of 3.5 that you have direct evidence for here. But Tony, you were saying that lensing gives you even more.
Actually, it's more than lensing. It gives you radii more, 300 kiloparsecs now. that's the distance where tidal stripping basically would start stripping off outside dark matter. But the whole distribution function, as you say, is is pretty close to isothermal, which is all you need to have that mathematical relationship that you have there. Mainly the mass grows linearly with radius.
It's expressed here as a contribution to the velocity at a certain radius, right? But what one would really like to see is what do you need for the mass density? You know, is it 1 over r or 1 over r?
It's just an energy argument. An f mv squared is equal to g over r.
Yeah, that
he
actually
has that density.
It is
this formula
shows the radius.
The green box before has that formula. I have two slides. The green box has the density.
Yeah. Well, if you go, if you follow this, and then basically from that curve, you can basically derive.
Okay.
Sorry.
I want to see rho versus r. If I could.
Previous slide.
Yeah. Well, I don't have it here.
You did on the previous slide.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
there you go.
You won't see this. Okay.
Rho was like 1 over r squared in 3 sites. Large radio.
And the scale factor is, you say, many times larger than a galaxy.
So the volume is R cubed, right? So it will grow.
Forget the A. Rho goes like 1 over R squared at large radius. Then out to some radius, it gets stripped. And that's 300 kilomorphs.
Okay. So it is more dense at the center of the galaxy.
Yeah.
Okay.
B is a top end.
Right. So, of course, now how do you detect this? There's many, many ways. So I'll just mention you can do indirectly. For example, all these WIMPs will be trapped in the sun when they travel through the sun many times. And when you collect enough and they meet their antiparticle, the anode, and the high energy neutrino will come out. This gives you a unique signature because you don't have such high energy neutrino coming from the sun by the normal process. So that if you see a very high energy neutrino, it has to be from dark matter. But of course, you can search this in the accelerator. You can create them in a collider. But you can discover SUSY here, but you can't discover dark matter. So a direct measurement of the dark matter is really a complementary with the accelerator search. Of course, if you detect dark matter here, you can't tell it's SUSY. So these two. So here, basically, what you do is we need a detector on the sun, and then all these dark matter particles are floating around with a certain velocity. So you need, so based on what the distribution, we basically know you have about 0.3 GeV per cubic centimeter around us. That's the amount of dark matter we're talking about. Now, so the sun is moving around the galaxy, and then the Earth around the sun. So basically, you have average velocity of this. So we're talking about assuming a 100 GeV particle. This is the amount of particles going through every square centimeter per second. So it's a huge amount of flux. But because the cross-section is so small in the weak scale, so the event rate is still very, very small. Okay.
Where do you get the 100 GeV
from? Well, just you assume. You can assume any mass because we don't know it yet. So, but from a weak scale, it's in the range of that. So it could be 50, it could be EV. Now, so in order to detect it, you have to have a target material. So I just show you this one, some of the argument people use to compare with different target. Okay. Here I just listed the xenon, argon, germanium, and silicon. So the argument here is this. We are trying to detect a nuclear recoil because this WIMP's coming in only weakly interact with the nuclei and transfer a small energy. So for different target, there's a form factor effect because when you have higher energy transfer to the nuclei, the form factor takes in. So the coherent effect here, A is the number is a number of the atom. So this is the cross-section of the WIMPs with the nuclei. So nucleon, sorry. So if you think about the xenon or argon as a whole, you have a coherent factor. So with larger A, you have much higher rate. So that's the hope in order to measure, because otherwise you will never get one event in even 100 years. But then the argument here is, if you look at smaller nuclei, the form factor effect is much, much smaller in high energy. When I say high energy, it's still in KeV range. So we're not talking about GeV high energy physics. But then, if you take into account this A factor, you take this integrated rate, now you find that xenon at low energy threshold give you much higher rate. So that basically means you build a certain amount of detector size, effectively give you much higher rate. Okay, so meaning it's more sensitive. Now, what kind of energy we're talking about? Now, we're talking about an elastic scattering between the waves coming in with the target. And taking into account the velocity I talked about, about 200 kilometers per second of the solar movement. The energy is only about 40 keV, 20 to 40 keV, transferred to the nuclei in your target. So that's the amount of energy you are going to see. It's really, really hard, because when we talk about high energy physics, it's always GeV, and you have plenty of information. So here, the difficulty is you need to design a detector sensitive to this energy range. Okay. This is just give you a different comparison of different target. So this is useful because once the dark matter is discovered, you need more than one target to look at the spectrum of the events in order to determine the energy, the mass of the target. So this is just assume 100 GeV WIMPs.
Just go back to the previous graph again. So yeah, okay, so 20 is sort of where you get the xenon advancement, okay.
Yeah, so basically across in here about 46 around, xenon is better. So you need a, on one hand you enhance a lot of rate, so you can be more sensitive, but on the other hand, you compare it better than other targets. So actually, when I show you later, our threshold is 5 keV,
mm-hmm.
electron equivalent, so it's about here.
What causes the depth?
Oh, this is just, if you depend on what kind of form factor you assume, and that is the Fourier transform, somewhere here is basically zero. Now, the multi-target measuring the spectrum is one way, but actually there's another way to really determine if what you see is dark matter is by annual modulation. What I mean is, this is the center of the galaxy, the sun is moving around the galaxy, but then the Earth is moving around the sun with a tilt, 60 degrees. What happens in the summer and winter, you modulate the velocity here, basically changing the rate. So if you see dark matter events, you assume they are, now you have to look at the modulation, see if it's in phase, in order to determine, okay, this is really coming from dark matter. Then this modulation actually is very small. You put it in, it's only a few percent. So what you see here, suppose we have, assume 50 GeV WIMPs or 100 GeV WIMPs. It's just like a 2% effect, but note here yet it's crossover at a certain threshold, the rate is higher in summer or winter, or the other way, and this is a 50 GeV target. Okay. Now, as I said, the rate is very, very low because the interaction is very rare, but then in all the detectors, it's contaminated by radioactivity. So what happened is, just imagine you have a 1 kilogram detector here. Anybody standing 2 meters away will give you thousands of events per day per kilogram material. And the dark matter signal we're talking about, today's limit, is about less than about 0.1 or below per event per kilogram per day. So we're talking about completely overrun by background around us. Anything around us will dominate the signal. So you have to design a detector really a low energy threshold and has to be capable to distinguish the background signal. So in order to single out the real signal. So one of the strategies is really go deep underground, because a lot of this background, not only from the contamination of materials, but also from cosmic rays. So you have to go really deep underground, either under the mountain or go deep in the mine. So in the Zeppelin cave, we go in a underground mine. So basically, a very high mountain will shield all the high energy cosmic energy. But then still a few very high energy muons will come in. But then you have to do even further to do some kind of veto. If you see a muon, you veto the signal. Okay. So on top of all this, you still have to worry about the contamination in your construction materials. So that's the key. You have to have a technique to discriminate background. So this is to show you the activities of experiments. Some of them I can't even pronounce. A lot of activities. So we are hoping, no, Zeppelin 2 is already in operation in the UK. Actually, it's here. In the future, we plan to go here. Actually, now we change the name to LUX. It's the new collaboration. We're hoping there's a new US deep underground science laboratory to build, and then we can go there. Right, so what is the trick to discriminate background? So basically, the two types of recoil. One is nuclear recoil, basically caused by WIMPs, or neutron background. So neutrons will give you the same kind of event signature as WIMPs. So we have to worry about neutron, a lot of work to eliminate neutron sources. The other is mainly the radioactive background coming from gamma rays. Okay, the trick is here. So if your detector response to these two types of signal are different, then you can do this kind of measurement. You measure two of the components, either ionization, scintillation, or thermal energy. Then this share is different. That gives you a discrimination. Okay. So one of the very early experiments, this is what I did in 93. Actually, this is in 1991, too, at CERN. Just for the principle, is it possible to discriminate background? So what we did is we used a gamma source, which is mostly the radioactive background. And at the time, we just used very high energy alpha to simulate a heavy ionization particle, basically the nuclear recoil event. So what you see here demonstrated is this is when the event happens, you have a primary scintillation light seen by a phototube. And then there's ionization coming out of the event. You measure the ionization by this phototube again. You see clearly these two types of events are different. Event by event, you can tell. One is the background event, one is the nuclear recoil event. So that's the starting point of this technology. Then, because you need to use liquid, and you want to measure the ionization part, which is the second one, and you have to drift it. So you need a pure liquid. You have to know if you can drift electron in the liquid. So you have to make liquid very pure. So that was done also very early. We designed a system, we did the purification. We designed a setup, we put liquid in it, injected some charge, you measure the charge, and you let the electron drift. And then you measure how much left after drift. Then you see, okay, this is what is left. And you can measure, we achieved very high purity in 93. That's about 5 milliseconds. Basically, electron can drift from here to the wall. So you don't have to worry about large detectors. You can build detector with very highly drift electrons. Okay, then we immediately built a smaller 2 kilogram detector in the 95, 96, and started all kind of all the light yield, charge yield, all kind of properties of liquid xenon, and a lot of fun. So this is all my thesis work. We also put this detector on the Mont Blanc in 96. But then because of some safety, it was not met there, so we have to move out. And then there's a big fire there, right after we left. So it killed 39 people there. Anyway, so now how do we know at low energy recoils? We can see the recoil events on the nuclei. So we designed another experiment to put it on neutron beam and put a liquid xenon cell with the neutron counter on the side so you can measure the angle. You measure the incoming neutron energy. Then you know how much energy you deposit in the recoil event. Then we measured a so-called quenching factor. Basically, you don't get the same amount of light out of compared with the same energy gammas, but you get enough up. So that confirms that we can see low energy recoils. Okay. Now, basically, the technology at that point it's already done, except we need to demonstrate in a bigger scale. So we built a two-phase detector, so I'll describe this later in the Zeppelin 2 detector. So this was done also very early in the 1970s, about 10 years ago. Okay, so just quickly summarize. Why we use xenon? First of all, you can buy in large quantities, so very cheap. Well, very cheap, relative to silicon detectors. But the annual product is like 30, 40 tons per year. So you can, we're talking about a few hundred kilograms. Another nice thing is there's spin-off isotope in xenon. Basically, once you discover dark matter, you want to know if it has a spin. So you can choose which isotope in order to measure the spin of the dark matter. Okay. As I mentioned, this coherent effect on the A number gives you a large event because it's cross-section proportional to A squared. So xenon is 130, so this factor is like 10 to the 4. Liquid xenon is very dense, 3 grams per cubic centimeter. So you can build a detector relatively small. When you see a ton scale, it's still a tabletop experiment. Okay. Of course, we need to measure at least two components in order to discriminate the background. So liquid xenon itself is a natural scintillator. So when you have events, they scintillate, give you 175 nanometer light. And as I mentioned, you can measure charge and drift and measure them. So this gives you the power to discriminate background. Are there some other, so as I mentioned already, so the light, well, the electron free path is very long, so you can design any size. The other thing is the light attenuation. You have to be able to measure the light when you build a bigger one. So the light attenuation is also about a meter, so it's not a problem. I think the most important here is xenon itself is pure in terms of radioactivity. The longest radioactive isotope of xenon lives like 36 days. So by itself, it's not contaminated by radioactivity. The key here is you can scale up because it's just liquid, very uniform. You build a bigger bucket, you put it in, and you get a much bigger detector. Okay, so very quickly, so when event coming in, I produce scintillation because it's intrinsic scintillator. Then this scintillation basically excited xenon, and then capture another one and form a dimer. That decays into a singlet and triplet decay. That give you a different time constant. Okay, and this is the share of these two components is different between different type of interactions. So radioactive background or nuclear recoil give you a different ratio. That is part of the discrimination. They're looking at the primary light. Now, if you put an electric field, you get an ionization component out. If you don't, this ionization will recombine and produce more light. But if you take it out and you measure it, that gives you another handle because the amount of ionization from background event and nuclear recoil event are also different. So, okay, this is the design of Zeppelin II detector. This is about 30 kilograms of xenon. So what do you do here is you design the system. This is the photo tube. This is the middle of the detector. You put the field rings around, and you make sure you have very uniform field. Then when the event happens, you will extract the charge, and charge drift up and goes on this area. So what you will see is a primary light coming from the event, either background events, gammas, or nuclear recoils from neutrons or WIMPs. This light will be viewed by phototube directly, so that's what we call S1. And then what happens to the charge is the charge will drift up and pass in a grid, and then goes to the liquid surface, and then the field here is so strong, you have to get the electron out of the surface. And what happened then is the electron were luminescent in the gas phase, just like the lamps in this room. So per electron, this gives you a lot of light. So because initially, as I said, the energy is so low, you don't have that many electrons coming out because it's low event. So you get a few electrons coming out, but then they produce a lot of light. You'll see with the same tube, with the delay. So here's what you will see. This is a signal. For example, here is very small. That's a primary signal when event happens. And then you drift electrons. After a long time, the electron goes to the surface and produces luminescence and give you a lot of light. So this is just a blow up of the primary here, and this is the secondary. Now this is, turns out this is the gamma event. Okay, now we put a neutron source, we look at the nuclear recoils of in the detector. You see the difference, this is the primary and secondary, but this shape compared with this S2 in the ratio, this is much, much smaller. That is the key for the discrimination. Okay. Right, so as I said, the electron coming out of the surface and luminescence, as you can see, so this is just to tell you how powerful this detector. A single electron coming out of the surface can be seen by this detector. This is the peak of the single electron from the surface. So it's very, very powerful. Okay. Okay, this is the Zeppelin II design. This is the cross section here. This is a CAD drawing. You can see everything inside. So liquid xenon are in this inner vessel, and then you thermally insulate with vacuum. There's 7 phototubes on top, and this is the field stripping rings to shape the field. Then this is the active volume. Then you bring all the signal cable, all the control, everything on top. And this is in room temperature. The thermal gradient is provided by this stainless steel wall here, because stainless is very bad thermal conductor. So actually, we started to build this thing 6 years ago, but it turns out we only finished now, like 6 years later. This is at UCLA machine shop. We have plenty of good machining and machines. And this is later, a year later, we had this vessel. The vessel is casted stainless steel, and then I did all the machining at UCLA. And this is in 2002. This is the real picture of the 7 phototubes. By the way, this tube works in cryogenic temperature. It works in liquid argon temperature, or even liquid nitrogen temperature. So 7 tubes, and put it on here, and this is the structure. You see, okay, we put the base all inside, high voltage here. This is interesting. This is the big plate because we have a cold head here. When you circulate, the liquid xenon drops on this. So we put a thing to block it. Okay, so this is some more details about, this is the field stripping rings. This is a resistor to link them to produce the uniform field. And then everything put inside another big Teflon tube, and then put the whole thing inside the detector. On top here, you see this grid, this double grid to produce luminescence. This is made in Texas, actually. So it was very carefully machined and tested in liquid and deformation and everything was carefully measured. Okay, this is the actual final integration underground in Bobby Mine. I'll show you later. So this is the copper, and you see all the inside, these things after this thing, and this is the tubes on top. Then, as I mentioned, even you're very deep underground, you still have to worry about background from your lab, from everything around you. So what you have to do, you have to install your detector with a very heavy shielding. This is lead shielding. But still, you can't shield the things inside your detector. So what you have to do, you do a VTOL. Some of the events may come in, deposit the event, and then leave your detector. And if you capture it outside, you can veto the event. So this is the whole setup. Actually, I took this picture 2 weeks ago. This is the big box, the lead box, and everything's inside. This is the purification system, electronics, and this is DAQ around here. So we have been continuously running more than 5 months. Collected a lot of data. Analysis is complete, just submitted 2 weeks ago. So this mine is in UK, near the York area. You see these are the mining underground. This is the sea. All this is under the sea. So the experiment is somewhere here underground. It's about 1 kilometer deep. Now this is the comparison of many different underground labs. So Bobby Mine is at here. What we hope the future U.S. is deep options, much deeper is here. Because this gave you a shield of the muons. you see many order magnitudes suppression of muon rate. Okay, so this is a look of one event. We have seven tubes, so each tube you record the whole waveform, and you see this one small primary. Some has some now because we're talking about very low energy event. And this is the S2 event, basically the ionization component. So keep in mind, this one are all happening on that liquid surface level. So looking at the size of this one relative to each tube, you can tell the XY location of the event.
I love experiments where the data comes out as scope traces. That's really
good. Oh, actually, this is the actually it's Aquarius sheet. Okay.
Which other count can fit on one page? That's the
yeah. We have okay. Well, we only have seven tubes, so in LUX we can't do this.
Yeah,
we have hundreds of tubes. But anyway.
So I was going to ask what the shape is for S2, but it's just the end of seven tubes.
This is just row traces now.
Yeah.
But then offline you do all kind of analysis, the shape of this, shape of that, the width, the area, you do all kind of analysis. Finally, I'll show you later, see how we... Okay, so this is a nice signal in the right range, it's low energy, but a lot of geometry, high energy event coming in, you see this thing. Basically, a very high energy in coming in primary, and then you drift. And then this big charge coming in gives you a huge secondary. As I said, this secondary is in the luminescence part, produce a lot of light. That light shines everywhere in the surface, produce secondary electrons. And the electrons come again, and then you produce all these events. So this kind of event, you can do a simple trigger in to veto it, so you don't even take it. So this you can see, this goes on and on for many, many, this is up to many milliseconds. So what we're really interested in is only 100 microseconds. Okay. One good thing for the, you do a big uniform detector is for neutron background. Neutron coming in, it bounces many times sometimes before it leaves. So if you take a primary and you look at the number of secondaries, you see clearly this is a neutron event trapped inside, it bounces around before it leaves. So I've seen events get up to 9 scatters because we record only 10 pulses. So I've seen 9 scatters inside. It's very nice. Now you get a very nice distribution, single scatter, 2 scatters, 3 scatters, all the way to 9 scatters. Okay. This is important because when WIMPs come in, give you one event, WIMPs are not going to interact again. Because so if you see double scatter, it must be neutrons. Okay, as I mentioned before, you look at the different the size of different S2 in the cube, it gives you XY information. So this is the measurement. Okay, what we need to do, we have to calibrate the detector. And gamma is very hard to, low energy gamma doesn't go in well, so we have to cut away materials to make sure we're very thin here. So we put a low energy gamma source here, cobalt 57. Now you see these clusters, because other places basically shielded by the copper. Then by calculating this, we get about a centimeter resolution to determine where the events are actually happening. But we also calibrate very carefully the energy scale with cobalt 57, and this is the primary distribution, this is the secondary distribution. But all the information we really need is from the primary. Okay, here's the final data. We need to know where to look for the WIMP event, basically the nuclear recoil event. So what we do is we send a neutron source in it. Now you observe all the recoil distributions. If there's any WIMP event, it will distribute like this. Okay. So based on this calibration, we set a 50% acceptance region, set a minimum. So we're just looking for events here after a long run. Then this band basically determined by gamma background. So you have to, because as I said, you need to discriminate background, basically gammas. You don't want to see any gammas. So you calibrate with cobalt 60 source, because cobalt 60 is high energy, can penetrate inside. So you populate low energy part. And then you do a feed, carefully study at the discrimination power you want. So that's where we determine, okay, this is 98, 99%. And
so
this
is coincidence that 50% of neutron is 99% rejection of.
This is just purely the discrimination of the system. You
just
can't,
works out to be that.
You can't do much about it. Because you can improve this if you get more, if you get more charges or less light, you play at different conditions. You can improve a little bit, but not very much. Okay.
Well, one question that was occurred to me is what's different about those events on the cobalt 60? The claim was, talking to Tom Schutt, he claimed that it was because of the ionization density and that it was fluctuations just due to the path of the electron curling back upon itself, which case is intrinsic and there's nothing you can ever do about it.
There's nothing more you can do, but actually...
But that's just a theory. It's not.
It's a theory, but seems to me the intrinsic is much better than this. But this also coupled with how you actually measure them. For example, you see the spread. That basically is the fluctuation of the S2.
Right.
Now, if your detectors, but it's in Zeppelin case, I don't have a transparency to show you. In Zeppelin case, the S2 fluctuates more than 100%. So if you improve that, you can reduce this spread. That improves the discrimination.
Okay, well, I'll talk about that later.
Yeah.
That almost is like a uniform population, not a fluctuation of.
Oh, if I show you the fluctuation.
Okay.
So I don't think the xenon atom shot is the ultimate best discrimination yet. I think we can still improve it. But so far we have 98.5%. Xenon have 99%. And this line is this line. So this is determined by this calibration. Then it happens you still cover 50% of your signal. So that's the whole analysis base. And then, so based on that, remember I said about VTOL. So this is when we open the box. So we've determined this box way before with all the calibration and everything. So we determine this box, and we open all our data. And this is what we see. Now, then we look at the VTOL system. Though these ones have signal in the VTOL, that means this must be in coincidence of something happening. So we throw away all those events, and here's what we see. We were hoping had nothing in it. That would be ideal, but at the end we had about 29 events in the box. So that's the base of our result. This one is really not expected, because we were expecting recoil events, gamma events, and what is this? So we spent a lot of time to try to understand. So what happened, this is radon events. The system is contaminated by radon. Radon decays, and the daughter drifts down and stays on the wall. Because it's on the wall, and the radon daughter decays, and that ionization, because it's on the wall, you lose some charge. So basically, you lose charge, this is this is plotted S2 over S1. So when you lose charge, your S2 gets smaller, so this drops down. And this leaks in some events. So basically, this will be eliminated if you don't have radon in the first place.
You may be making radon, though, by uranium-thorium contamination. Sorry.
Actually, this we confirm exactly where it comes from. It's coming from the purification system.
Okay.
It's the getter. Because, as I said, even though we manage the purity, but you still have to continuously purify because of the outgassing deteriorate the lifetime. And then this getter, we need to get xenon pass together, and the getter produces radon and feed into the system. Anyway, so based on that, we have to be understand exactly how much event we expect to see here based on the distribution here. Based on this distribution, so we made very careful study on the distribution.
Using your position sensitivity, have you localized these to the walls?
Oh yeah.
Okay, cool.
We started with 30 kilograms. At the end, the analysis is only 7.2 kilograms. Because this charge is small, the XY resolution become poor, they leak into it. So we have to squeeze and finally find a small region to get rid of the event on the side. Okay, so you study all this, looking at the distribution, you try to predict, based on this run, how many events leak into the box. So this is the banana, we call it banana event. This one, and then the gamma event. So based on that, we expect 28.6 events. We see 29. And then once this is done, everything is done. You just go on and then you check the 90% confidence. So this is total exposure, and this is the total mass we use. Now we get a limit at 6.6 10 to minus 7 picobonds at the lower point is 65 GeV.
That's only 30 days in 6 years.
Well, 7 kilograms. It's about 30 days.
Okay.
Because this is the really effective time take, but then because of efficiency, you cut away that time.
Okay.
You do calibration, so it takes a long time to get this. Yeah. Okay, so that's the first liquid xenon two phase limit. Now. This is the one I always show in my talk, because I just dream about what is the final detector. All the background basically dominated by phototube. You want to do something without phototube, okay? So we are here. This one is waiting for money, but it's already on the ground, Zeppelin 3. So I was thinking, you put this phototube bottom top, you get the next phase, but then Xenon 10 already did that. So to reduce the phototube, you can manipulate the electron any way you want, you get a smaller number of tubes, or even do extreme, why don't you just make a circle? So I have another 5 minutes?
Sure.
So let me go here. So what happened here is we need to see the primary light by phototubes, and you need a lot of tubes in order for the coverage, because you need to handle this threshold. So what you do is, instead, what if I put a cysteine iodide cathode here? Your entire detector surface becomes a photocathode. So your light coming here, you produce photoelectrons, and then it drifts up and you measure them. So you can intricately get a very low background, very low energy threshold detector. But then why don't you go even further? You make it circular. So what happened here, you put some kind of a charge readout device. I did some study very early with thin wires, but there's some ways, but I haven't had time to confirm it yet.
This is single phase, right?
This is single phase. You should be able to measure charge. I already did it with 3-micron wire. But if you do a nanotip shape, like this cold emission device,
mm-hmm.
but you run it reverse, you should be able to amplify the charge and read it. In that case, you put a system iodide photocathode around here, you get a whole detector as a photocathode. So you get very low energy threshold. But then you put xenon here, that acts as self-shielding. So then you can get a very low background environment without phototubes. That would be my dream, but we have to go step by step. So what we do now is this new LUX collaboration. Based on what we learned from Zeppelin 2 and also xenon collaboration, I didn't say anything about it, but same technology, liquid xenon. So we come out a conclusion that today, with the technology we learn, we don't need R&D to build this detector. Okay. So what the plan is here, you put a lot of phototubes at bottom and top. The reason to put it here is because in Zeppelin 2, we know light doesn't come out very easily because of total internal reflection. And also because of the gas and the window material, the light doesn't couple well. So you get much higher light collection efficiency with tubes inside the liquid. But then you have to do something about the background from the tubes. So we on purposely have a long distance here, because xenon is a very good gamma shielding material, because the interaction length is only 2 centimeters, 2.7. So the probability of the events actually coming here and then coming here is very low. So intrinsically, you produce a very low background environment. We made it very tall because we want to cut away the top part due to this PMT. Then we end up having a 100 kilogram detector here. Okay? So the plan here is, of course, Bob is involved in the water tank outside. So the reason for this is because you can scale this easily once you finish this one. You can build any size. And the second is, the shielding we use for Zeppelin II, we use lead with all the materials. Solid materials, contamination is very hard to take away. But you can purify water very easily. So this is just one idea you can think about, how to fix the thing inside the water, move it around up and down, and do surveys, stuff like that. Maybe just quickly summarize. The goal for LOX is a 300 kilogram detector with 100 kilogram fiducial. Based on what we learned about discrimination, the acceptance, all the experience about the different prototypes, that feed in, say, we don't really need any R&D to go ahead and build this big one. Here's the team. We have Brown Case, Livermore, LBL, Rochester, Texas, Davis here, and UCLA. We assume the background basically dominated by the PMT. And right now, the PMT, as we understand from Harmon Marshall, guaranteed that with this system design, we can get this 10 to the minus 4. The current experiment is about 10 to the minus 1. So we have several order of magnitude improvement. I already mentioned we use a big water tank outside to shield external background. So that's what we were hoping for. This is 10 to minus 42 in this number. So, 10 to minus 43. Mm-hmm. So this is a goal of just improve about more than two order of magnitude of this current technology. Now, of course, funding is not in place yet. So what we can do? We can do a smaller version, just test all the rest of the system. And then as soon as we stabilize that, we can convince the agency and then have a full system. Currently, we are trying to build a smaller one. So actually, part of my reason here is also talking to the machine shop we already did to do some machining work here to actually make this detector. So this will be the final one. The whole collaboration actually really started to talk about it like October last year, in a few months. Now, we already had pieces arrived yesterday. This is the outer vessel, inner vessel, flanges on top, and this is tongue and case. So this is two vessels basically. It's this two. Already exists. Right. So this is an overall goal compared with what is happening. So this is the result I showed Zeppelin 2. This is current bias limit from CDMS2. This is a cryogenic detector. For LOX, when fully integrated with the water shield and everything, with about 120 days run, we can reach here, okay? Give a significant amount of bite on this predicted parameter space.
What's that yellow under the black?
The yellow one, I can't see.
Snow.
This is
CDMS at Snow Lab.
This is super CDMS at Snow Lab.
Oh, okay.
That corresponds to the blue curve?
That's the blue curve.
Okay.
Yeah. And this is the LOX curve. But take a look here, because we're talking about this is 100 kilograms. With all the performance we're talking about, you need 120 days. But to reach this with super CDMS, you need 1,000 days to collect this image.
And truckload of money. Right? Cost is an order of magnitude higher.
Okay, thank you.
There is no direct limit on the mass. All the limits on the mass are indirect, and they're all very low in the EB to KdV range.
Oh.
So if you can think of ways to get your threshold down, it's worthwhile. And on plots like this, we really should plot the left edge all the way to zero.
I think 40 GeV or below is already excluded, right?
No,
not completely.
No. What you have to do is you can't couple with the Z.
Well, that's I think the reason why people are pushing.
So if it doesn't couple to the Z, what is the, how do we detect it?
It annihilates through a light CPI or similar resonance.
There has to be some other particle. There has to be another particle mediating its annihilation with the standard model.
But it won't be, this is a nuclear detector.
Everything else is the same. I mean, so it would interact with nuclei. It's got some scattering cross-section, but the threshold is way down. In some cases, this happens with Higgs's. Annihilation occurs through a Higgs, and the direct detection cross-section also occurs through a different Higgs.
Okay.
And this gets you all the way down to zero.
Yeah, the energy source of what's happening to now, because we have only tube on top. When you put the tube on the bottom, you basically increase about three times the amount of light. So the energy threshold can go down. That's the reason we have. Also, this, I didn't say, this PTFE basically acts as a reflector. So we will put it around for the lux also, purely for the light collection efficiency. Because we really at the end, it's only the last spin at the lower threshold is sensitive for the whole.
How far down is there some hope of going in terms of threshold? I mean, we're envisioning particles, like at the mass of 3 or 4 GeV, or maybe even lower. But let's say 3 or 4 GeV. What is the recoil energy in that case?
It's only 20, 30, 40 KeV. So
less than that. That's what.
So for 100 GeV, your recoil is 20 KeV, right? So for
depend on the, yeah, sure.
Yeah,
for 4 GeV, you won't use xenon, you want something light, you go to helium.
Right, well, that's what I'm getting at.
Right,
so
I mean,
you guys are the experimental experts, so I'm just throwing this out there. You can think of ways to do this kind of thing.
Well, that's like tennis ball hitting the xenon.
It's hard.
Yeah, bowling ball, you're not going to.
Yeah, that's
okay.
Right.
That's
so,
let's see.
No expertise required.
This is this is the reason if I have the opportunity, I want to push this because this whole surface basically 4 pi to collide the light. That pushes the energy threshold down to below 1 KeV. Because we're talking about now 5 to KeV above. So you can improve a lot here. So, but this is really far in the future.
Why is it? So far in the future, I mean,
because the agency doesn't have the money to support.
Well, I guess that's the question: how expensive or how big a deal is?
The thing is here is this thing. I haven't got a chance to confirm this will work yet. But all the experience and some other tests I did make me feel this will work. But I can't prove it. I can't say it's working now. You need R&D. But then right now. All the other work make us ready to do this next phase. So this is basically something on the side. If we get money forward, and this behind the scene, we have to do this.
So you say it could get down to 1 KeV.
Energy threshold. Yeah.
Like that. So what would that mean in terms of that plot? I mean, what would you think your line would look like if you could do this?
Oh, okay. So
final plot.
Then this curve moves this way. And then it goes down like this because you're more sensitive, because you get much more events, because the form factor effect also goes away because you're much closer to that. So basically this curve goes this way. Well, it's still like this.
So how far down do you think you could go using that technique? I mean, on this.
Then it will also depend on how big is your detector and all other factors, so I can't really say. But you get more sensitive in this way, as you're saying, you need a lower mass.
Well,
you still need
right? I mean, you choose xenon because of A squared,
right?
But it's also sort of with the 50 to 100 GeV object in mind, since comparable masses. But if you were going so low for the for the incident particle, you'd have to rethink your target.
It's
neon.
Neon is probably better than xenon. So that will, I mean, I don't think people are thinking along this line yet in this business. I mean, everybody's trying to go for the standard.
Yeah, I understand, yeah, of course.
But it's the one tooth fairy rule. Having it just coupled to Z and just having it exist as a wimp is one tooth fairy, but if you put it in
well,
a
it's
model,
a tooth fairy with 127 parameters. It's the emphasis. Yeah. Which is worse?
I don't have to make up a new interaction.
Well,
that's
so let's put it this way. You can add two particles to the standard model to solve the dark matter problem. You add the dark matter, you add a mediator.
I don't care about Susie.
Susie has
interaction, it's a cross section. I don't care about
perhaps we should have a meeting about this tomorrow. With our visitor is here tomorrow, maybe.
Yeah.
We should set up the time, a half hour, 1 hour.
Yeah.
Other questions,
yeah.
Or should we?
Okay.
Question? Let's thank the speaker again.